I pause, as though I'm actually considering this, as though I'm weighing my options, as though the RSVP to her invitation is in question. Then I shrug, put on a good show. Sure, why not? But I'm still a little iffy about the bus station, so I put on my shades and cap before we go inside. Mia leads me through an orange-tiled hall, the aroma of pine disinfectant not quite masking the smell of piss, and up a series of escalators, past shuttered newsstands and fast-food restaurants, up more escalators to a neon sign blaring Leisure Time Bowl. Here we are, she says, shyly, proudly. After I found it by accident, I made a habit of peeking in any time I was in the station. And then I started coming here just to hang out. Sometimes I sit at the bar and order nachos and watch people bowl. Why not bowl yourself? Mia tilts her head to the side, then taps her elbow. Ah, her elbow. Her Achilles heel. One of the few parts of her body that, it seemed, hadn't been hurt in the accident. Hadn't been encased in plaster, or put together with pins, or stitches, or touched by skin grafts. But when she started playing cello again in that mad attempt to catch up with herself, her elbow had started to hurt. X-rays were taken, MRIs done. The doctors couldn't find anything wrong, told her it might be a bad bruise or a contused nerve, and suggested she ease off the practicing, which had set Mia off. She said if she couldn't play, she had nothing left. What about me? I remember thinking, but never saying. Anyhow, she'd ignored the doctors and played through the pain, and either it had gotten better or she'd gotten used to it. I tried to get some people from Juilliard to come down a few times, but they weren't into it. But it doesn't matter, she tells me. It's the place I love. How it's totally secreted away up here. I don't need to bowl to appreciate it. So your Garden of Eden boyfriend is too highbrow for greasy diners and bowling alleys, huh? Mia and I used to go bowling, sometimes the two of us, other times with her whole family. Kat and Denny had been big bowlers, part of Denny's whole retro thing. Even Teddy could hit an 80. Like it or not, Mia Hall, you have a bit of grunge twined into your DNA thanks to your family. And maybe thanks to me. We could go bowling now, I suggest. Mia smiles at the offer, then taps her elbow again. She shakes her head. You don't have to bowl, I explain. I'll bowl. You can watch. Just for you to get the whole effect. Or I can even bowl for both of us. It seems like you should have one game here, this being your farewell tour. You'd do that for me? And it's the surprise in her voice that gets to me. Yeah, why not? I haven't been bowling in ages. This isn't entirely true. Bryn and I went bowling a few months ago for some charity thing. We paid $20,000 to rent a lane for an hour for some worthy cause, and then we didn't even bowl. Just drank champagne while Bryn schmoozed. I mean, who drinks champagne at a bowling alley? Inside Leisure Time, it smells like beer, and wax, and hot dogs, and shoe disinfectant. It's what a bowling alley should smell like. The lanes are full of an unusually unattractive grouping of New Yorkers who actually seem to be bowling for the sake of bowling. They don't look twice at us. They don't even look once at us. I book us a lane and rent us each a pair of shoes. Full treatment here. Mia's practically giddy as she tries hers on, doing a little soft shoe as she selects a lady's pink 8-pounder for me to bowl with on her behalf. What about names? Mia asks. Back in the day, we always went for musicians. She'd choose an old-school punk female singer, and I'd pick a male classical musician. Joan and Frederick, or Debbie and Ludwig. You pick, I say, because I'm not exactly sure how much of the past we're supposed to be reliving, until I see the names she inputs, and then I almost fall over. Kat and Denny. When she sees my expression, she looks embarrassed. They like to bowl, too. She hastily explains, quickly changing the names to Pat and Lenny. How's that? She asks, a little too cheerfully. 2 letters away from morbid, I think. My hand is shaking again as I step up to the lane with Pat's pink ball, which might explain why I only knocked down 8 pins. Mia doesn't care. She squeals with delight. A spare will be mine, she yells, then catches her outburst and looks down at her feet. Thanks for renting me the shoes. Nice touch. No problem. How come nobody recognizes you here? She asks. It's a context thing. Maybe you can take off your sunglasses? It's kind of hard talking to you in them. I forgot that I still had them on and feel stupid for it, and stupid for having to wear them in the first place. I take them off. Better, Mia says. I don't get why classical musicians think bowling is white trash. It's so fun. I don't know why this little Juilliard snobs versus the rest of us should make me feel a little digging thrill, but it does. I knock down the remaining two of Mia's pins. She cheers loudly. Did you like it, Juilliard? I ask. Was it everything you thought it'd be? No, she says, and again I feel this strange sense of victory, until she elaborates. It was more. Oh. Didn't start out that way, though. It was pretty rocky at first. That's not surprising, you know, all things considered. That was the problem. All things considered. Too many things considered. When I first got there, it was like everywhere else. People were very considerate. My roommate was so considerate that she couldn't look at me without crying. The over-empathizer. Her, I remember. I got cut off a few weeks into her. All my roommates were drama queens. I changed so many times the first year before I finally moved out of the dorms. Do you know I've lived in 11 different places here? I think that must be some kind of record. Consider it practice for being on the road. Do you like being on the road? No. Really? Getting to see all those different countries? I would have thought you'd love that. All I get to see is the hotel and the venue and the blur of the countryside from the window of a tour bus. Don't you ever sightsee? The band does. They go out on these private VIP tours, hit the Rome Coliseum before it's open to the public and things like that. I could tag along, but it would mean going with the band, so I just wind up holed up in my hotel. There's not usually time, I lie. So you were saying you had roommate issues? Yeah, Mia continues. Sympathy overload. It was like that with everyone, including the faculty, who were all kinds of nervous around me, when it should have been the opposite. It's kind of a rite of passage when you first take orchestra to have your playing deconstructed, basically picked apart in front of everyone. And it happened to everybody, except me. It was like I was invisible. Nobody dared critique me. And trust me, it wasn't because my playing was so great. Maybe it was, I say. I edge closer, drying my hands over the blower. No, it wasn't. One of the courses you have to take when you first start is string quartet survey. And one of the profs is this guy, Lemsky. He's a bigwig in the department. Russian. Imagine every cruel stereotype you can think of. That's him. Mean, shriveled up little man. Straight out of Dostoevsky. My dad would have loved him. After a few weeks, I get called into his office. This is not usually a happy sign. He's sitting behind this messy wooden desk with papers and sheet music piled high. And he starts telling me about his family. Jews in the Ukraine. Lived through pogroms. Then through World War II. Then he says, everyone has hardship in their life. Everyone has pain. The faculty here will coddle you because of what you went through. I, however, am of the opinion if we do that, that car crash might as well have killed you too, because we will smother your talent. Do you want us to do that? And I didn't know how to respond, so I just stood there. And then he yelled at me, do you? Do you want us to smother you? And I managed to eke out a no. And he says, good. Then he picks up his baton and sort of flicks me out with it. I can think of places I'd like to stick that guy's baton. I grab my ball and hurl it down the lane. It hits the pin formation with a satisfying thwack. The pins go flying in every direction like little humans fleeing Godzilla. When I get back to Mia, I'm calmer. Nice one, she says at the same time I say, your professor sounds like a dick. True, he's not the most socially graced. And I was freaked out at the time, but looking back, I think that was one of the most important days of my life, because he was the first person who didn't just give me a pass. I turn, glad to have a reason to walk away from her so she can't see the look on my face. I throw her pink ball down the lane, but the torque is off and it veers to the right. I get 7 down and the remaining 3 are split. I only pick off one more on my next go. To even things up, I purposely blow my next frame, knocking down 6 pins. So, a few days later in orchestra, Mia continues, my glissando gets taken apart, and not very kindly. She grins, awash in happy memories of her humiliation. Nothing like a public flogging. Right? It was great. It was like the best therapy in the world. I look at her. Therapy was once a forbidden word. Mia had been assigned a grief counselor in the hospital and rehab, but had refused to continue seeing anyone once she'd come home, something Kim and I had argued against. But Mia had claimed that talking about her dead family an hour a week wasn't therapeutic. "Once that happened, it was like everyone else on the faculty relaxed around me," she tells me. "Lemsky rode me extra hard. No time off. No life that wasn't cello. Summers, I played festivals. Aspen, then Marlboro. Then Lemsky and Ernesto both pushed me to audition for the Young Concert Artist Program, which was insane. It makes getting into Juilliard look like a cakewalk. But I did it, and I got in. That's why I was at Carnegie tonight. 20-year-olds don't normally play recitals at Sankel Hall. And that's just thrown all these doors wide open. I have management now, I have agents interested in me, and that's why Lemsky pushed for early graduation. He said I was ready to start touring, though I don't know if he's right." From what I heard tonight, he's right. Her face is suddenly so eager, so young, it almost hurts. "Do you really think so? I've been playing recitals and festivals, but this will be different. This will be me on my own. Or soloing for a few nights with an orchestra or a quartet or a chamber music ensemble." She shakes her head. "Some days, I think I should just find a permanent position in an orchestra, have some continuity, like you have with the band. It has to be such a comfort to always be with Liz, Mike, and Fitzy." The stage changes, but the players stay the same. I think of the band, on an airplane as we speak, speeding across the Atlantic. A notion, the least of the things dividing us now. And then I think of Mia, of the way she played the Dvorak, of what all the people in the theater were saying after she left the stage. "No, you shouldn't do that. That would be a waste of your talent. Now you sound like Lemsky." "Great." Mia laughs. "Oh, I know he comes across as such a hard ass, but I suspect deep down he's doing this because he thinks by giving me a shot at a career, he'll help fill some void." Mia stops and turns to me, her eyes dead on mine, searching, reaching. "But he doesn't have to give me the career. That's not what fills the void. You understand that, right? You always understood that." Suddenly all the shit from the day comes ricocheting back. Vanessa and Bryn and the bump watches and shuffle and the looming 67 days of separate hotels and awkward silences and playing shows with a band behind me that no longer has my back. And it's like, "Mia, don't you get it? The music is the void, and you're the reason why." Chapter 11. Shooting Star had always been a band with a code. Feelings first, business second. So I hadn't given the band much thought, hadn't considered their feelings or their resentments about my extended leave. I figured they'd get my absence without my having to explain. After I came out of my haze and wrote those first 10 songs, I called Liz, who organized a band dinner meeting. During dinner, we sat around the club table, so named because Liz had taken this fugly 1970s wooden dining table we'd found on the curb and covered it with band flyers and about 1,000 layers of lacquer to resemble the inside of a club. First, I apologized for going MIA. Then I pulled out my laptop and played them recordings of the new stuff I'd been writing. Liz's and Fitzy's eyes went wide. They dangled vegetable lasagna in front of their mouths as they listened to track after track. Bridge, Dust, Stitch, Roulette, Animate. "Dude, we thought you were just packing it in, working some crap-ass job and pining, but you've been productive," Fitzy exclaimed. "This shit rocks." Liz nodded. "It does, and it's beautiful too. It must have been cathartic," she said, reaching over to squeeze my hand. "I'd love to read the lyrics. Do you have them on your computer?"
"Scrawled on paper at home. I'll transcribe them and email them to you."
"Home? Isn't this home?" Liz asked. "Your room is an untouched museum. Why don't you move back?"
"Not much to move, unless you sold my stuff."
"We tried. Too dusty, no takers," Fitzy said. "We've been using your bed as a hat rack, though."
Fitzy shot me a wise-ass grin. I'd made the mistake of telling him how I'd thought I was turning into my dead grandfather, with all his weird superstitions, like his vehement belief that hats on beds bring bad luck.
"Don't worry, we'll burn sage," Liz said. Clearly Fitzy had alerted the media.
"So what, that's it?" Mike said, tapping his nails against my laptop.
Dude, that's 10 songs, Fitzy said, a piece of spinach in his giant grin. 10 insanely good songs. That's practically an album. We already have enough to go into the studio.
Those are just the ones that are done, I interrupted. I've got at least 10 more coming. I don't know what's going on, but they're just kind of flowing out of me right now. Like they're already written and recorded and someone just pressed play. I'm getting it all out as fast as I can.
Obey the muse, Liz said. She's a fickle mistress.
I'm not talking about the songs, Mike said. We don't even know if there will be any album, if any of the labels will still want us. We had all this forward momentum and he basically killed it.
He didn't kill anything, Liz said. For one, it's only been a few months. And second of all, our Smiling Simon album has been ripping up the indie charts, getting tons of play on the college stations. And I've been working the college angle pretty well, Liz continued, with interviews and all to keep the embers burning. And dude, Perfect World has even crossed over. It's getting play on satellite radio stations, Fitzy said. I'm sure all those A&R guys will be happy to see us, shitting bricks to hear this.
You don't know, Mike said. They have their trends, quotas, the outfits they want. And my point is, he jabbed a finger at me, ditches the band without a word and just waltzes back like it's no big deal.
Mike had a point, but it wasn't like I held anyone back.
Look, I'm sorry. We all go off the cliff sometimes, but you could have replaced me if you'd wanted to, gotten a new guitar player in your major label deal.
By the quick look that passed among the three of them, I could see that this option had been discussed and likely vetoed by Liz. Shooting Star was a democratic outfit. We'd always made decisions together, but when it came down to it, the band was Liz's. She started it and recruited me to play guitar after seeing me play around town. Then she'd lassoed Fitzy and Mike, so ultimately a personnel change would have been her call. Maybe this was why Mike had started playing gigs with another drummer under the name of Ranch Hand.
Mike, I don't get what you want out of this, Fitzy said. Do you want a box of chocolates? Do you want Adam to get you a nice bouquet to say sorry?
Piss off, Fitz, Mike said.
I'll buy you flowers, I offered. Yellow roses. I believe those symbolize friendship.
Whatever it takes, I'll do what I'm told.
Will that make it good? Fitzy continued.
Because what the fuck, man? We have these amazing songs. I wish I'd written those songs, but Adam did. He came through and we have him back. So maybe now we can get back to making kick-ass music and see where it takes us. And maybe, you know, let our kid get a little joy back in his life. So dude, bygones.
Mike's worries turned out to be unfounded. Some of the major labels that had been courting us in the fall had cooled on us, but a handful were still interested. And when we sent them the demos of the songs that would become Collateral Damage, they went ballistic, and we were signed and in the studio with Gus before we knew it. And for a while, things were good. Fitzy and Liz were both right. Recording Collateral Damage was cathartic. And there was joy. Working with Gus was intense. He brought out the noise in us, told us not to be scared of our raw power, and we all ran with it. And it was cool being up in Seattle recording and staying in a corporate apartment and feeling like the shit. Everything seemed good. Not long after the record came out, the tour started. A 5-month slog through North America, Europe, and Asia that, at the outset, seemed like the most exciting thing in the world. And in the beginning, it was. But it was also grueling. And soon I was tired all the time. And lonely. There was a lot of empty time in which to miss her. I kind of holed away in my hotel rooms, the backs of tour buses. I pushed everyone away, even Liz. Especially Liz. She wasn't stupid. She knew what was going on and why. And she wasn't some fragile flower either. She kept after me. So I burrowed until I guess she got tired of trying to dig me out. As the tour went on, the album just started going haywire. Platinum, then double platinum. The tour dates sold out, so our promoters added additional ones to meet demand. The merchandising deals were everywhere. Shooting Star t-shirts, caps, posters, stickers, even a special edition Shooting Star telescope. Suddenly, the press was all over us. Interviews all the time, which was flattering at first. People cared enough about us to read what we had to say. But a weird thing started to happen in interviews. The reporter would sit the band down together, ask some perfunctory questions to us all, and then turn the microphone or camera on me. And I tried to open it up to the rest of the band.
That's when reporters started requesting interviews with just me,
a request I uniformly turned down until it suddenly became impossible for us to do interviews any other way. About 4 months into the tour, we were in Rome. Rolling Stone had sent a reporter to spend a few days with us. One night after a show, we were closing the hotel bar. It was a pretty mellow scene, and we were sitting around, decompressing, pounding grappa. But then the reporter starts firing away with all these heavy-duty questions, all to me. I mean, there were about a dozen of us in there. Me, Liz, Fitzy, Mike, Aldous, some roadies, some groupies. But this guy was acting like I was the only person in the room.
Adam, do you see collateral damage as having a single narrative? If so, can you elaborate on it? Adam, do you think this record represents your growth as a songwriter? Adam, you've mentioned in other interviews you don't want to go down that dark rock star path, but how do you keep from suffocating on your own fumes?
Mike just lost it.
You hijacked the band!
He screamed at me, like it was just the two of us in a room, like there wasn't a reporter right there.
This isn't just the Adam Wilde show, you know. We're a band, a unit. There are four of us. Or did you forget that on your way down the dark rock star path?
Mike turned to the reporter.
You want to know about the illustrious Adam Wilde? I've got some choice details. Like, our rock star over here has to do this crazy voodoo shit before each show and is such a prima donna that if you whistle backstage before a show, he has a tantrum because of the bad luck.
Mike, come on, Liz interrupted sharply. All artists have their rituals. The reporter, meanwhile, was scribbling away, eating all this up, until Aldous diplomatically said that everyone was tired and shooed everyone but the band out of the bar and tried to get me and Mike to make nice. But then Mike just let loose for round two of insults, telling me what a spotlight-hogging asshole I'd become. I looked over at Liz to come to my defense again, but she was staring intently at her drink, so I turned to Fitzy, but he just shook his head.
I never thought I'd be the one to say this, but grow up, you two.
And then he left. I looked pleadingly at Liz. She looked sympathetic, but tired.
Mike, you were out of line in there, she said flatly. But then she turned to me and shook her head. But Adam, come on. You've got to try to see it from his perspective, from all of ours. It's tough to be big about this, especially when you've retreated from us. I get why you have, but that doesn't make it any easier.
All of them. They were all against me. I waved my hands in surrender. I ran out of the bar, strangely close to tears. In the lobby, this Italian model named Raffaella, who'd been hanging with us, was waiting for a taxi. She smiled when she saw me. When her taxi came, she gestured with her head, inviting me inside, and I went. The next day, I checked into a different hotel from the band. The story hit RollingStone.com almost immediately, and the tabloids a few days later. Our label freaked, as did our tour promoters, all of whom warned of the various forms of hell there would be to pay if we didn't honor our concert commitments. Aldous flew in a professional mediator to talk to me and Mike. She was useless. Her genius idea, a legacy that continues to this day, is what Fitzy refers to as the divorce. I would continue to stay at one hotel for the remainder of the tour, the rest of the band at another. And her publicist decided it was safer to keep me and Mike separate in interviews, so now reporters often talk to me solo. Yeah, those changes have helped a lot. When I got back from the collateral damage tour, I almost quit the band. I moved out of the house I'd been sharing with Fitzy in Portland and into my own place. I avoided those guys. I was angry, but also ashamed. I wasn't sure how, but I clearly ruined everything. I might have just let the run end there, but Liz stopped by my new place one afternoon and asked me to just give it a few months' breathing space and see how I felt.
Anyone would be going a little nuts after the couple years we've had, especially the couple of years you've had, she'd said,
which was about as much as we acknowledged Mia.
I'm not asking you to do anything. I'm just asking you to not do anything and see how you feel in a few months.
Then the album started winning all these awards, and then I met Bryn and moved to L.A. and didn't have to deal with them much, so I just wound up getting sucked in for another round. Bryn's the only person who knows how close to the edge that tour pushed me, and how badly I've been dreading this upcoming one.
Cut them loose, is her solution.
She thinks I have some sort of guilt complex, coming from humble origins and all, and that's why I won't go solo.
Look, I get it. It's hard to accept that you deserve the acclaim, but you do. You write all the songs and most of the music, and that's why you get all the attention, she tells me. You're the talent, not just some pretty face. If this were a movie,
You'd be the $20 million star, and they'd be the supporting players. But instead, you all get an equal split, she says. You don't need them, especially with all the grief they give you.
But it's not about the money. It never has been. And going solo doesn't seem like much of a solution. It would just be out of the frying pan and into the fire, and there'd still be touring to contend with, the thought of which has been making me physically sick.
Why don't you call Dr. Weisbluth?
Bryn suggested on the phone from Toronto, where she was wrapping her latest film. Weisbluth's the psychopharmacologist the label had hooked me up with a few months earlier.
See if he can give you something a little stronger. And when you get back, we need to have a sit-down with Brooke and seriously talk about you going solo. But you have to get through this tour. You'll blow your reputation otherwise.
There are worse things to blow than your reputation, aren't there? That's what I thought, but I didn't say it. I just called Weisbluth, got some more scripts, and steeled myself for the tour. I guess Bryn understood, like I understood, like everyone who knew me understood, that in spite of his bad boy rep, Adam Wilde does as he's told. Chapter 12. There's a piece of lead where my heart should beat. Doctor said too dangerous to take out. You better just leave it be. Body grew back around it, a miracle, praise be. Now, if only I could get through airport security. Bullet. Collateral damage, track 12. Mia doesn't tell me what the next destination is. Says because it's her secret New York tour, it should be a secret. And then proceeds to lead me out of Port Authority, down, 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 into a warren of subway tunnels. And I follow her, even though I don't like secrets. Even though I think that Mia and I have enough secrets between the two of us at this point, and even though the subway is like the culmination of all my fears, enclosed spaces, lots of people, no escape. I sort of mention this to her, but she throws back what I said earlier in the bowling alley about context.
Who's going to be expecting Adam Wilde on the subway at 3 a.m, without an entourage?
She gives me a joking smile.
Besides, it should be dead at this hour, and in my New York, I always take the train.
When we reach the Times Square subway station, the place is so crowded that it might as well be 5 p.m. on a Thursday.
My warning bell starts to ping. Even more so once we get to the thronged platform. I stiffen and back toward one of the pillars. Mia gives me a look. This is a bad idea, I mumble, but my worries are drowned out by the oncoming train.
The trains don't run often at night, so it must be that everyone's been waiting for a while, Mia shouts over the clatter. But here comes one now, so look, everything's fine.
When we get on the N, we both see that Mia's wrong. The car is packed with people. Drunk people. I feel the itchiness of eyes on me. I know I'm out of pills, but I need a cigarette. Now. I reach for my pack.
You can't smoke on the train, Mia whispers.
I need to.
It's illegal.
I don't care. If I get arrested, at least I'd be in the safety of police custody. Suddenly, she goes all Vulcan.
If the purpose is to not call attention to yourself, don't you think that perhaps lighting up is counterproductive?
She pulls me into a corner.
It's fine,
she croons, and I half expect her to caress my neck like she used to do when I'd get tense.
We'll just hang out here. If it doesn't empty out at 34th Street, we'll get off.
At 34th, a bunch of people do get off, and I feel a little better. At 14th, more people get off. But then suddenly at Canal, our car fills up with a group of hipsters. I angle myself into the far end of the train, near the conductor's booth, so my back is to the riders. It's hard for most people to understand how freaked out I get by large crowds in small contained spaces now. I think it would be hard for the me of 3 years ago to understand. But that me never had the experience of minding his own business at a small record shop in Minneapolis when one guy recognized me and shouted out my name, and it was like watching popcorn kernels in hot oil. First one wind, then another, then an explosion of them, until all these sedate record store slackers suddenly became a mob, surrounding me, then tackling me. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't move. It sucks because I like the fans when I meet them individually. I do. But get a group of them together and this swarm instinct takes over, and they seem to forget that you're a mere mortal, flesh and bone, bruisable, and scarable. But we seem okay in the corner, until I make the fatal mistake of doing just one final check over my shoulder to make sure no one's looking at me. And in that little quarter second, it happens.
I catch someone's eye. I feel the recognition ignite like a match. I can almost smell the phosphorus in the air. Then everything seems to happen in slow motion. First I hear it. It goes unnaturally quiet. And then there's a low buzz as the news travels. I hear my name and stage whispers move across the noisy train. I see elbows nudged, cell phones reached for, bags grabbed, forces rallied, legs shuffling. None of this takes longer than a few seconds, but it's always agonizing, like the moments when a first punch is thrown but hasn't yet connected. One guy with a beard is preparing to step out of his seat, opening his mouth to call my name. I know he means me no harm, but once he outs me, the whole train will be on me. 30 seconds to all hell breaks loose. I grab Mia's arm and yank.
Ow!
I have the door between subway cars open, and we're pushing into the next car.
What are you doing?
She says, flailing behind me. I'm not listening. I'm pulling her into another car, then another, until the train slows into a station, and then I'm tugging her out of the train, onto the platform, up the stairs, taking them two at a time. Some part of my brain vaguely warning me that I'm being too rough, but the other part not giving a shit. Once up on the street, I pull her along for a few blocks until I'm sure no one is following us. Then I stop.
Are you trying to get us killed?
She yells. I feel a bolt of guilt shoot through me, but I throw the bolt right back at her.
Well, what about you? Are you trying to get me attacked by a mob?
I look down and realize that I'm still holding her hand. Mia looks too. I let go.
What mob, Adam?
She asks softly. She's talking to me like I'm a crazy person now, just like Aldous talks to me when I have one of my panic attacks. But at least Aldous would never accuse me of fantasizing a fan attack. He's seen it happen too many times.
I got recognized down there,
I mutter, walking away from her. Mia hesitates for a second, then skitters to catch up.
Nobody knew it was you.
Her ignorance, the luxury of that ignorance.
The whole car knew it was me. What are you talking about, Adam?
What am I talking about? I'm talking about having photographers camped out in front of my house. I'm talking about not having gone record shopping in almost 2 years. I'm talking about not being able to take a walk without feeling like a deer on the opening day of hunting season. I'm talking about every time I have a cold, it showing up in a tabloid as a coke habit.
I look at her there in the shadows of the shutdown city, her hair falling onto her face, and I can see her trying to figure out if I've lost it. And I have to fight the urge to take her by the shoulders and slam her against a shuttered building until we feel the vibrations ringing through both of us. Because I suddenly want to hear her bones rattle. I want to feel the softness of her flesh give, to hear her gasp as my hip bone jams into her. I want to yank her head back until her neck is exposed. I want to rip my hands through her hair until her breath is labored. I want to make her cry and then lick up the tears. And then I want to take my mouth to hers. To devour her alive, to transmit all the things she can't understand.
This is bullshit. Where the hell are you taking me anyway?
The adrenaline thrumming through me turns my voice into a growl. Mia looks taken aback. I told you, I'm taking you to my secret New York haunts.
Yeah, well, I'm a little over secrets. Do you mind telling me where we're going? Is that too much to fucking ask?
Christ, Adam, when did you become such a...
egomaniac? Asshole? Narcissist? I could fill in the blank with a million words. They've all been said before.
Guy!
Mia finishes. For a second, I almost laugh. Guy? That's the best she's got? It reminds me of the story my parents tell about me. How when I was a little kid and would get angry, I'd get so worked up and then curse them out by going, you, piston... like it was the worst thing ever. But then I remember something else. An old conversation Mia and I had late one night. She and Kim had this habit of categorizing everything into diametric categories, and Mia was always announcing a new one. One day she told me that they decided that my gender was divvied into two neat piles. Men and guys. Basically, all the saints of the world. Men. The jerks, the players, the wet t-shirt contest aficionados. They were guys. Back then, I was a man.
So I'm a guy now? A guy?
I allow my hurt to show for half a second. Mia's looking at me with confusion, but not remembering a thing. Whoever said that the past isn't dead had it backward. It's the future that's already dead, already played out. This whole night has been a mistake. It's not going to let me rewind, or unmake the mistakes I've made, or the promises I've made, or have her back, or have me back. Something's changed in Mia's face. Some type of recognition has clicked on, because she's explaining herself, how she called me a guy, because guys always need to know the plan, the directions, and how she's taking me on the Staten Island ferry, which isn't really a secret, but it's something few Manhattanites ever do. Which is a shame, because there's this amazing view of the Statue of Liberty, and on top of that, the ferry is free, and nothing in New York is free. But if I'm worried about crowds, we can forget it. But we can also just check it out, and if it's not empty, and she's pretty sure it will be this time of night, we can get right back off before it leaves.
And I have no idea if she remembered that conversation about the man-guy distinction or not, but it doesn't really matter anymore.
Because she's right. I am a guy now. And I can peg the precise night I turned into one. Chapter 13. The groupies started showing up right away. Or maybe they'd always been there and I just hadn't noticed. But as soon as we started touring, they were buzzing about like hummingbirds dipping their beaks into spring flowers. One of the first things we did after we signed with the label was hire Aldous to manage us. Collateral Damage was due to come out in September, and the label planned a modest tour in the late fall, but Aldous had different ideas.
"You guys need to get your sea legs back," Aldous said when we finished mixing the album. "You need to get back on the road."
So right as the album came out, Aldous booked us a series of 10 tour dates up and down the West Coast in clubs we'd played in before to reconnect with our fan base, or to remind them that we still existed, and to get comfortable playing in front of an audience again. The label rented us a nice Econoline van, tricked out with a bed in the back and a trailer to haul our gear. But other than that, when we set out, it didn't feel that different from the shows we'd always played. It was completely different. For one, right away, and for whatever reason, Animate was breaking out as a hit single. Even over the course of the two-week tour, its momentum was building, and as that happened, you could feel it in every consecutive show we played. They went from well-attended, to packed, to sold out, to lines around the corner, to fire marshals showing up. All in the matter of 2 weeks. And the energy. It was like a live wire. Like everyone at the shows knew we were right there on the verge, and they wanted to be a part of it. A part of our history. It was like we were all in on this secret together. Maybe that's why these were the best, most frenetic, rocking shows we'd ever played. Tons of stage diving and people shouting along to the songs, even though nobody had heard any of our new stuff before. And I felt pretty good, pretty vindicated, because even though it was just a matter of pure luck that things had gone this way, I hadn't blown it for the band after all. The groupies just seemed part of this wave of energy, this growing swell of fandom. At first, I didn't even think of them as groupies, because a lot of the girls I'd known vaguely from the scene. Except whereas before, they'd been friendly. Now they were brazen in their flirting. After one of our first shows in San Francisco, this hipster chick named Viv, who I'd known for a few years, came backstage. She had glossy black hair and wiry arms covered in a daisy chain of tattoos. She gave me a huge hug and then a kiss on the mouth. She hung by my side all night long, her hand resting on the small of my back. At that point, I'd been out of commission for well over a year. Mia and I, well, she'd been in the hospital, then in rehab, and even if she hadn't been covered in stitches, plaster, and pressure bandages, there was no way. All those fantasies about sexy hospital sponge baths are a joke. There is no place less of a turn-on than a hospital. The smell alone is one of putrefaction, the opposite of desire. When she'd come home, it had been to a downstairs room that had been her grand sewing room, which we'd turn into Mia's bedroom. I'd slept on a nearby couch in the living room. There were spare rooms on the second floor, but Mia, who was still walking with a cane, couldn't handle the stairs at first, and I hadn't wanted to be even that far away. Even though I was spending every night at Mia's, I'd never officially moved out of the House of Rock, and one night, a few months after Mia had come back to her grandparents, she'd suggested we go there. After dinner with Liz and Sarah, Mia had tugged me up to my room. The minute the door clicked shut behind us, she'd pounced on me, kissing me with her mouth wide open, like she was trying to swallow me whole. I'd been taken aback at first, freaked out by the sudden ardor, worried that it was going to hurt her, and also not really wanting to look at the stubbly red scar on her thigh where the skin had been taken for her graft, or to bang against the snakeskin-like scar on her other leg, even though she kept that one covered with a pressure bandage. But as she kissed me, my body had begun waking up to her, and with it, my mind had gone too. We laid down on my futon, but then, right as things had gotten going, she'd started crying. I couldn't tell at first, because the little sobs had sounded just the same as the little moans she'd been giving off moments before. But soon they'd grown in intensity, something awful and animal coming from deep within her. I'd asked if I'd hurt her, but she said that wasn't it and asked me to leave the room. When she'd come out fully dressed, she'd asked to go home. She tried to start things up with me once more after that, a summer night a few weeks before she'd left for Juilliard. Her grandparents had gone away to visit her Aunt Diane, so we'd had the house to ourselves for the night, and Mia had suggested we sleep in one of the upstairs bedrooms, since by then the stairs were no longer a problem for her. It had been hot. We'd opened the windows and kicked off the antique quilt and just gotten under the sheet. I remember feeling all self-conscious, sharing a bed with her after all that time. So I'd grabbed a book for myself, then propped up a row of pillows for Mia to bolster her leg against, like she liked to at night. "I'm not ready to sleep," she'd said, running a finger down my bare arm. She'd leaned in to kiss me, not the usual dry peck on the lips, but a deep, rich, exploring kiss. I'd started to kiss her back, but then I'd remembered that night at the House of Rock, the sound of her animal keening, the look of fear in her eyes when she'd come out of the bedroom. No way was I sending her down that wormhole again. No way was I going down that wormhole again. That night in San Francisco, though, with Viv's hand playing on the small of my back, I was raring to go. I spent the night with her at her apartment, and she came with me the next morning to have breakfast with the band before we took off for our next stop. "Call me next time you're in town," she whispered in my ear as we parted ways. "Back on the horse, my man," Fitzy said, high-fiving me as we piloted the van south. "Yeah, congratulations," Liz said, a little sadly. "Just don't rub it in." Sarah had recently finished law school and was working for a human rights organization. No more dropping everything to be Liz's plus one on tours anymore. "Just because you and Mikey are all tied down, don't come sobbing to us," Fitzy said. "Tour time is playtime, right, Wild Man?" "Wild Man?" Liz asked. "Is that how it's going to be?" "No," I said. "Hey, if the name fits," Fitzy said. "Good thing I hit Fred Meyer for the economy box of condoms before we left." In L.A., there was another girl waiting, and in San Diego, another. But none of it felt skeevy. Ellie, the girl in L.A., was an old friend, and Lena, the one in San Diego, was a grad student, smart and sexy and older. Nobody had any illusions that these flings were leading to grand romance. It wasn't until our second-to-last gig that I met a girl whose name I never did catch. I noticed her from the stage. She locked eyes on me the entire set and wouldn't stop staring. It was weirding me out, but also building me up. I mean, she was practically undressing me with her eyes. You couldn't help but feel powerful and turned on, and it felt good to be so obviously wanted again. Our label was throwing us a CD release party after the show, invitation only. I didn't expect to see her there, but after a few hours, there she was, striding up to me in an outfit that was half hooker, half supermodel. Skirt cut up to there, boots that could double as military-grade weaponry. She marched right up to me and announced in a not-too-quiet voice, "I've come all the way from England to fuck you." And with that, she grabbed my hand and led me out the door into her hotel room. The next morning was awkward, like none of the morning afters had been. I did a walk of shame to the bathroom, quickly dressed and tried to slip out, but she was right there, packed and ready to go. "What are you doing?" I asked.
"Coming with you?"
she said, as though it was obvious. "Coming with me where?"
"To Portland, love."
Portland was our last show and a sort of homecoming as we'd all be basing there now. Not in a communal House of Rock anymore. Liz and Sarah were getting their own place. Mike was moving in with his girlfriend, and Fitzy and I were renting a house together. But we were all still in the same area, within walking distance to one another and the rehearsal space we now rented. "We're in a van, not a tour bus," I told her, looking down at my Converse. "And Portland's the last show, a kind of friends and family thing. You shouldn't come. And you are not my love. She frowned and I'd slunk out the door, thinking that was the last of it. But when I showed up to soundcheck in Portland, she was there, waiting for me in the Satyricon. I told her to leave, not very nicely. It was along the lines of, there's a name for this, and it's called stalking. I was a dick, I know, but I was tired. I'd asked her not to come, and she was freaking me out in a big way. Not just her. 4 girls in 2 weeks was doing my head in. I needed to be alone.
Piss off, Adam. You're not even a bloody rock star yet, so stop acting like such a self-important wanker. And you weren't even that good.
This she shouted in front of everyone. So I had the roadies throw her out. She left screaming insults about me, my sexual prowess, my ego.
Wild man indeed, Liz said, raising an eyebrow.
Yeah, I said, feeling like the opposite of a wild man, actually wanting to sneak into a room and hide. I didn't know it yet, but once the real tour started, the one our label sent us on after the album went haywire, a 5-month slog of sold-out shows and groupies galore, all I'd wanted to do was hide. Given my isolationist tendencies, you'd think I'd have learned to stay away from the freebie affection on such constant offer. But after shows, I craved connection. I craved skin, the taste of another woman's sweat. If it couldn't be hers, well, then anyone's would do, for a few hours. But I'd learned one lesson. No more overnight guests. So that night in Seattle may have been the first time I became a guy, but it wasn't the last.
Chapter 14. The boogeyman sleeps on your side of the bed, whispers in my ear, better off dead. Fills my dreams with sirens and lights of regret, kisses me gently when I wake up in a sweat. Boo. Collateral damage, track 3. I go with Mia to the ferry anyway, because what else am I going to do? Throw a tantrum because she hasn't kept an up-to-date catalog of every conversation we've ever had? It's called moving on. And she's right about the ferry being dead. At 4:30 in the morning, not a lot of demand for Staten Island. There may be a dozen people sprawled out in the downstairs deck. One trio of late-night stragglers is sacked out on a bench, rehashing the evening. But as we pass them, one of the girls lifts her head and stares at me. Then she asks her friend,
"Dude, is that Adam Wilde?"
The friend laughs.
"Yeah, and next to him is Britney Spears. Why the hell would Adam Wilde be on the Staten Island ferry?"
I'm asking myself the same question. But this is apparently one of Mia's things, and this is her farewell to New York, even though I'm not actually leaving to her. So I follow her upstairs to the bow of the boat near the railing. As we pull away from New York, the skyline recedes behind us, and the Hudson River opens up to one side, the harbor to the other. It's peaceful out here on the water. Quiet, except for a pair of hopeful seagulls following in our wake, squawking for food, I guess, or maybe just some company in the night. I start to relax in spite of myself. And after a few minutes, we're close to the Statue of Liberty. She's all spotlit in the night, and her torch is also illuminated, like there's really a flame in there, welcoming the huddled masses. "Yo, lady, here I am." I've never been to the Statue of Liberty. Too many crowds. Aldous once invited me on a private helicopter tour, but I don't do choppers. But now that she's right here, I can see why this is on Mia's list. In pictures, the statue always looks kind of grim, determined. But up close, she's softer. She has a look on her face, like she knows something you don't.
"You're smiling,"
Mia says to me. And I realize I am. Maybe it's being granted a special pass to do something I thought was off limits. Or maybe the statue's look is contagious.
"It's nice," Mia says. "I haven't seen it in a while."
"It's funny," I reply, "because I was just thinking about her." I gesture toward the statue. "It's like she has some kind of secret, a secret to life." Mia looks up.
"Yeah, I see what you mean."
I blow air out my lips. "I could really use that secret." Mia tilts her head out over the railing.
"Yeah? So ask her for it."
"Ask her?
She's right there. No one's here, no tourists crawling around her feet like little ants. Ask her for her secret."
"I'm not going to ask her."
"You want me to do it?" I will, but it's your question, so I think you should do the honors.
You make a habit of talking to statues?
Yes, and pigeons. Now, are you going to ask?
I look at Mia. She's got her arms crossed across her chest, a little impatient. I turn back to the railing. Statue? Oh, Statue of Liberty? I call out quietly. No one is around, but this is still really embarrassing.
Louder,
Mia prods. What the hell?
Hey, excuse me,
I call out.
What's your secret?
We both cock our ears out over the water, as though we expect an answer to come racing back.
What did she say?
Mia asks. Liberty.
Liberty,
Mia repeats, nodding in agreement.
No, wait, I think there's more. Hang on.
She leans out over the railing, widening her eyes.
Aha.
She turns to me.
Apparently, she isn't wearing any underwear under her robes, and with the bay breeze, it provides a certain frisson.
Lady Liberty's going commando,
I say. That is so French. Mia cracks up at that.
Do you think she ever flashes the tourists?
No way.
Why do you think she has that private little look on her face? All those Red State Puritans coming by the boatload, never once suspecting that old Libs hasn't got panties on. She's probably sporting a Brazilian.
Okay, I need to lose that visual,
Mia groans.
And might I remind you that we're from a red state? Sort of.
Oregon's a divided state, I reply. Rednecks to the east, hippies to the west.
Speaking of hippies and going commando...
Oh no, now that's a visual I really don't need.
Memory Liberation Day!
Mia crows, referring to some 60s holdover in our town. Once a year, a bunch of women spend the day topless to protest the inequity that it's legal for men to go shirtless, but not women. They do it in the summer, but Oregon being Oregon, half the time it's still freezing. So there was a lot of aging, puckered flesh. Mia's mom had always threatened to march. Her dad had always bribed her with a dinner out at a fancy restaurant not to.
Keep your Class B misdemeanor off my B cups,
Mia says, quoting one of the movement's more ridiculous slogans between gasps of laughter.
That makes no sense. If you're bearing your boobs, why a bra?
Sense? It was some stoner hippie idea and you're looking for logic?
Mammary Liberation Day,
Mia says, wiping away the tears.
Good old Oregon. Oh, that was a lifetime ago.
And it was. So the remark shouldn't feel like a slap, but it does. How come you never went back? I ask. It's not really Oregon's abandonment, I want explained, but it seems safer to hide under the big green blanket of our state.
Why should I?
Mia asks, keeping her gaze steady over the water. I don't know. The people there?
The people there can come here.
To visit them, your family, at the... Oh, shit, what am I saying?
You mean the graves?
I just nod.
Actually, they're the reason I don't go back.
I nod my head. Too painful. Mia laughs, a real and genuine laugh, a sound about as expected as a car alarm in a rainforest.
No, it's not like that at all. She shakes her head. Do you honestly think that where you're buried has any bearing on where your spirit lives?
Where your spirit lives?
Do you want to know where my family's spirits live?
I suddenly feel like I'm talking to a spirit, the ghost of rational Mia.
They're here,
she says, tapping her chest.
And here,
she says, touching her temple.
I hear them all the time.
I have no idea what to say. Were we not just making fun of all the new agey hippie types in our town 2 minutes ago? But Mia's not kidding anymore. She frowns deeply, swivels away.
Never mind.
No, I'm sorry.
No, I get it. I sound like a rainbow warrior, a freak, a Looney Tune.
Actually, you sound like your gran. She stares at me.
If I tell you, you'll call the guys with the straitjackets.
I left my phone at the hotel.
Right.
Also, we're on a boat.
Good point.
And if by chance they do show up, I'll just offer myself up. So, what, do they, like, haunt you? She takes a deep breath and her shoulders slump as if she's setting down a heavy load. She beckons me over to one of the empty benches. I sit down next to her.
Haunt is not the right word for it. Haunt makes it sound bad, unwelcome. But I do hear them, all the time.
Oh.
Not just hear their voices, like the memory of them, she goes on. I can hear them talk to me, like now, in real time, about my life.
I must give her a weird look, because she blushes.
I know, I hear dead people, but it's not like that. Like, remember that crazy homeless woman who used to wander around the college campus claiming she heard voices broadcast to her shopping cart?
I nod. Mia stops for a minute.
At least, I don't think it's like that, she says. Maybe it is. Maybe I am nuts and just don't think I am because crazy people never think they're crazy, right? But I really do hear them. Whether it's some kind of angel force like Gran believes, and they're up in some heaven on a direct line to me, or whether it's just the them I've stored inside me, I don't know. And I don't know if it even matters. What matters is that they're with me, all the time. And I know I sound like a crazy person mumbling to myself sometimes, but I'm just talking to Mom about what skirt to buy, or to Dad about a recital I'm nervous about, or to Teddy about a movie I've seen. And I can hear them answer me, like they're right there in the room with me, like they never really went away. And here's what's really weird. I couldn't hear them back in Oregon. After the accident, it was like their voices were receding. I thought I was going to totally lose the ability to remember what they even sounded like. But once I got away, I could hear them all the time. That's why I don't want to go back. Well, one of the reasons. I'm scared I'll lose the connection, so to speak.
Can you hear them now? She pauses, listens, nods. What are they saying?
They're saying it's so good to see you, Adam.
I know she's sort of joking, but the thought that they can see me, keep tabs on me, know what I've done these last 3 years, it makes me actually shudder in the warm night. Mia sees me shudder, looks down.
I know, it's crazy. It's why I've never told anyone this. Not Ernesto, not even Kim.
No, I want to tell her. You got it wrong. It's not crazy at all. I think of all the voices that clatter around in my head, voices that I'm pretty sure are just some older or younger or just better versions of me. There have been times when things have been really bleak that I've tried to summon her, to have her answer me back, but it never works. I just get me. If I want her voice, I have to rely on memories. At least I have plenty of those. I can't imagine what it would be like to have had her company in my head. The comfort that would have brought. To know that she's had them with her all this time, it makes me glad. It also makes me understand why, of the two of us, she seems like the sane one. Chapter 15. I'm pretty sure that when babies are born in Oregon, they leave the hospital with birth certificates and teeny tiny sleeping bags. Everyone in the state camps. The hippies and the rednecks, the hunters and the tree huggers, rich people, poor people, even rock musicians, especially rock musicians. Our band had perfected the art of punk rock camping, throwing a bunch of crap into the van with like an hour's notice and just driving out into the mountains, where we drink beer, burn food, jam on our instruments around the campfire, and sack out under the open sky. Sometimes on tour back in the early hard scrabble days, we'd even camp as an alternative to crashing in another crowded, roach-infested rock and roll house. I don't know if it's because no matter where you live, the wilderness is never that far off, but it just seemed like everyone in Oregon camped. Everyone that was, except for Mia Hall. I sleep in beds, was what Mia told me the first time I invited her to go camping for a weekend. To which I'd offered to bring one of those blow-up air mattresses, but she'd still refused. Kat had overheard me trying to persuade Mia and had laughed. Good luck with that, Adam, she'd said.
Denny and I took Mia camping when she was a baby. We planned to spend a week at the coast, but she screamed for 2 days straight and we had to come home. She's allergic to camping.
It's true, Mia had said.
I'll go,
Teddy had offered.
I only ever get to go camp in the backyard.
Gramps takes you out every month, Denny had replied. And I take you. You just don't get to go camping with all of us as a family. He'd given Mia a look. She'd just rolled her eyes back at him. So it shocked me when Mia agreed to go camping. It was the summer before her senior year of high school and my first year of college, and we'd hardly seen each other. Things with the band had really started heating up, so I'd been touring for a lot of that summer, and Mia had been away at her band camp and then visiting relatives. She must have been really missing me. It was the only explanation I could imagine for her relenting. I knew better than to rely on the punk rock mode of camping, so I borrowed a tent and one of those foam things to sleep on, and I packed a cooler full of food. I wanted to make everything okay, though, to be honest, I wasn't really clear on why Mia was so averse to camping in the first place. She was not a prissy chick, not by a long shot. This was a girl who liked to play midnight basketball, so I had no idea if the creature comforts would help. When I went to pick her up, her whole family came down to see us off, like we were heading off on a cross-country road trip instead of a 24-hour jaunt. Kat waved me over.
What'd you pack for food? She asked.
Sandwiches, fruit, for tonight hamburgers, baked beans, s'mores. I'm trying for the authentic camping experience.
Kat nodded, all serious.
Good. Though you might want to feed her the s'mores first if she gets cranky.
Also, I packed you some provisions.
She handed me a half-gallon Ziploc. In case of emergency, break glass. What's all this stuff?
Now and Laters, Starburst, Pixie Sticks. If she gets too bitchy, just feed her this crap. As long as the sugar high is in effect, you and the wildlife should be safe.
Well, thanks. Kat shook her head.
You're a braver man than I. Good luck.
Yeah, you'll need it, Denny replied. Then he and Kat locked eyes for a second and started cracking up. There were plenty of great camping spots within an hour's drive, but I wanted to take us somewhere a little more special, so I wound us deep into the mountains, to this place up an old logging road I'd been to a lot as a kid. When I pulled off the road onto a dirt path, Mia asked, "Where's the campground?" "Campgrounds are for tourists. We free camp."
"Free camp?"
Her voice rose in alarm. "Relax, Mia. My dad used to log around here. I know these roads. And if you're worried about showers and stuff..."
"I don't care about the showers."
"Good. Because we have our own private pool." I turned off my car and showed Mia the spot. It was right alongside the river, where a small inlet of water pooled calm and crystal clear. The view in all directions was unfettered, nothing but pine trees and mountains, like a giant postcard advertising Oregon.
"It's pretty," Mia admitted, grudgingly.
"Wait till you see the view from the top of the ridge. You up for a walk?" Mia nodded. I grabbed some sandwiches and waters and two packs of watermelon now and laters, and we traipsed up the trail, hung out for a while, read our books under a tree. By the time we got back down, it was twilight. "I'd better get the tent up," I said.
"You need some help?"
"No, you're the guest. You relax, read your book or something."
"If you say so."
I dumped the borrowed tent pieces on the ground and started to hook up the poles, except the tent was one of those newfangled ones, where all the poles are in one giant puzzle piece, not like the simple pup tents I'd grown up assembling. After half an hour, I was still struggling with it. The sun was dipping behind the mountains, and Mia had put down her book. She was watching me, a bemused little smile on her face. "Enjoying this?" I asked, perspiring in the evening chill.
"Definitely. Had I known this was what it would be like, I would have agreed to come ages ago."
"I'm glad you find it so amusing."
"Oh, I do. But are you sure you wouldn't like some help? You'll need me to hold a flashlight if this takes much longer."
I sighed, held my hands up in surrender. "I'm being bested by a piece of sporting goods."
"Does your opponent have instructions?"
"It probably did at some point." She shook her head, stood up, grabbed the top of the tent.
"Okay, You take this end, I'll do this end. I think the long part loops over the top here.
10 minutes later, we had the tent set up and staked down. I collected some rocks and some kindling for a fire pit and got a campfire going with the firewood I'd brought. I cooked us burgers in a pan over the fire and baked beans directly in the can.
I'm impressed, Mia said.
So you like camping?
I didn't say that, she said, but she was smiling.
It was only later, after we'd had dinner and s'mores and washed our dishes in the moonlit river, and I'd played some guitar around the campfire, as Mia sipped tea and chowed through a pack of Starburst, that I finally understood Mia's issue with camping. It was maybe 10 o'clock, but in camping time, that's like 2 in the morning. We got into our tent, snuggled into the double sleeping bag. I pulled Mia to me. Want to know the best part about camping? I felt her whole body tense up, but not in the good way.
What was that?
She whispered.
What was what? I heard something, she said.
It was probably just an animal, I said. She flicked on the flashlight.
How do you know that?
I took the flashlight and shined it on her. Her eyes were huge.
You're scared?
She looked down and barely nodded her head. The only thing you need to worry about out here is bears, and they're only interested in the food, which is why we put it all away in the car, I reassured her.
I'm not scared of bears, Mia said disdainfully.
Then what is it?
I just feel like such a sitting target out here.
Sitting target for who?
I don't know. People with guns. All those hunters.
That's ridiculous. Half of Oregon hunts. My whole family hunts. They hunt animals, not campers.
I know, she said in a small voice. It's not really that either. I just feel defenseless. It's just, I don't know. The world feels so big when you're out in the wide open. It's like you don't have a place in it when you don't have a home.
Your place is right here, I whispered, laying her down and hugging her close. She snuggled into me.
I know, she sighed. What a freak. The granddaughter of a retired Forest Service biologist who's scared of camping.
That's just the half of it. You're a classical cellist whose parents are old punk rockers. You're a total freak, but you're my freak. We lay there in silence for a while. Mia clicked off the flashlight and scooted closer to me.
Did you hunt as a kid? She whispered. I've never heard you mention it.
I used to go out with my dad, I murmured back. Even though we were the only people within miles, something about the night demanded we speak in hushed tones. He always said that when I was 12, I'd get a rifle for my birthday and he'd teach me to shoot. But when I was maybe 9, I went out with some older cousins and one of them loaned me his rifle. And it must have been beginner's luck or something because I shot a rabbit. My cousins were all going crazy. Rabbits are small and quick and hard for even season hunters to kill, and I'd hit one on my first try. They went to get it so we could bring it back to show everyone and maybe stuff it for a trophy. But when I saw it all bloody, I just started crying. Then I started screaming that we had to take it to a vet, but of course it was dead. I wouldn't let them bring it back. I made them bury it in the forest. When my dad heard, he told me that the point of hunting was to take some sustenance from the animal, whether we eat it or skin it or something. Otherwise, it was a waste of a life. But I think he knew I wasn't cut out for it, because when I turned 12, I didn't get a rifle. I got a guitar.
You never told me that before, Mia said.
Guess I didn't want to blow my punk rock credibility.
I would think that would cement it, she said.
Nah. But I'm emo core all the way, so it works. A warm silence hung in the tent. Outside, I could hear the low hoot of an owl echo in the night. Mia nudged me in the ribs.
You're such a softie.
This from the girl who's scared of camping, she chuckled. I pulled her closer to me, wanting to eradicate any distance between our bodies. I pushed her hair off her neck and nuzzled my face there. Now you owe me an embarrassing story from your childhood, I murmured into her ear.
All my embarrassing stories are still happening, she replied.
There must be one I don't know. She was silent for a while. Then she said,
Butterflies.
Butterflies?
I was terrified of butterflies.
What is it with you and nature?
She shook with silent laughter.
I know, she said.
And can there be a less threatening creature than a butterfly? They only live like 2 weeks. But I used to freak any time I saw one. My parents did everything they could to desensitize me. Bought me books on butterflies, clothes with butterflies, put up butterfly posters in my room, but nothing worked.
Were you, like, attacked by a gang of monarchs? I asked.
No, she said. Gran had this theory behind my phobia. She said it was because one day I was going to have to go through a metamorphosis, like a caterpillar transforming into a butterfly, and that scared me. So butterflies scared me.
That sounds like your Gran. How'd you get over your fear?
I don't know. I just decided not to be scared of them anymore, and then one day, I wasn't.
Fake it till you make it.
Something like that.
You could try that with camping.
Do I have to?
Nah, but I'm glad you came. She'd turned to face me. It was almost pitch black in the tent, but I could see her dark eyes shining.
Me too. But do we have to go to sleep? Can we just stay like this for a while?
All night long, if you want. We'll tell our secrets to the dark.
Okay.
So let's hear another one of your irrational fears. Mia grasped me by the arms and pulled herself into my chest, like she was burrowing her body into mine.
I'm scared of losing you,
she said in the faintest of voices. I pushed her away so I could see her face and kiss the top of her forehead. I said irrational fears, because that's not going to happen.
It still scares me,
she murmured. But then she went on to list other random things that freaked her out, and I did the same. And we kept whispering to each other, telling stories from our childhoods, deep, deep into the night, until finally Mia forgot to be scared and fell asleep. The weather turned cool a few weeks later, and that winter was when Mia had her accident. So that actually turned out to be the last time I went camping. But even if it weren't, I still think it would be the best trip of my life. Whenever I remember it, I just picture our tent, a little ship glowing in the night, the sounds of Mia's and my whispers escaping like musical notes, floating out on a moonlit sea.